listen. Let me tell you a story about a village that is built with his glory. No sorrow in this place. Just lift your voice and say, let's celebrate. Look like it's gonna be a lovely day. Come on, everybody, let's celebrate. Forget the worries, throw your problems away. Come on, everybody, let's celebrate.
Show your smile, show your smile, show your smile now.
Everybody, let's celebrate.
Oh, 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 oh.
Everybody, let's celebrate.
Hello and welcome to the Village Celebration Podcast. I'm Vicki Newton. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been almost a week since what most Americans call the Muslim ban went into effect. And since then, there's been chaos, protests, and efforts to understand what exactly this means for Muslims in America, trying to come to America, and those around the world. How un-American is the ban? We are talking today with an expert on Muslim Americans. Dr. Edward Curtis has lectured in Cambridge. He's lectured at universities around the country and in mosques. He's a professor who has written 8 books. His PhD is from the University of South Africa, and we are honored to have him join us to talk about one of the most important conversations underway in America today. Dr. Curtis, let's just get right into the conversation. What are your thoughts about this travel ban?
Well, the travel ban doesn't make any sense. It won't make us safer, and it seems to be mostly a blatantly racist move against people who happen to be Muslim.
You know, it seems that the country is divided on this issue as it is on so many others. What do you think of those 50% or so who actually think this is a good idea?
Well, you know, I am very happy in one sense that we know what many of us who either are people of color or who have studied people of color have thought for a long time, mm-hmm. which is that the country is deeply racist. It has never, it is a post-slavery society that has never reckoned with its original sins of Native American genocide and African slavery. I'm glad that for those of us who told for many years that we were just imagining that the country was racist, that we were making it up in our mind, we now have really good hard evidence that no, we haven't been making it up in the mind. Half of people think it's okay to ban people who are not like them because they have a different religion or they come from a different country.
The evidence is clear. And
yes,
there's the 50% who seem okay with it, and then there are the rest of us who are protesting in the streets. Have you ever seen anything like this in America?
Yes. I mean, I think people may have forgotten that during the second Gulf War, the Iraq invasion, 40% of Americans were against that war. And similar numbers of people came out all over the country and all over the world on February 15th, I think it was, 2003, to protest what we knew was going to be a disaster for our country and the world. And of course, with the birth of ISIS and events subsequent to the Iraq invasion in 2003, I think, you know, we've been proven right. That was not the right decision for our country.
Your most recent book is titled Muslim Americans in the Military, Centuries of Service. So let's go back, if we can, to the 2016 election, which, although it was just a few months ago, seems like it may have been years ago. During the election at the Democratic Convention, candidate Hillary Clinton invited the parents of a young Muslim captain killed in Iraq to speak. The Khans spoke of their son's sacrifice and the loud voices spewing skepticism about Muslim Americans. Why was that a defining moment in the campaign and set the stage, if you will, in so many ways for what we see today?
Yeah, it was a defining moment, and it was choreographed as such. If you remember, Humayun Khan's parents appeared just before Hillary Clinton's daughter, Chelsea, introduced the candidate herself. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, you only put speeches that are really, really important to the identity of your campaign in that position, mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's all leading up to that moment. And so Hillary Clinton was in part trying to stake her campaign on the idea of what might be called consensus liberalism. And this is an idea that has been popular since the era of Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was mm-hmm. president in the 1950s. He was actually a liberal in the following way. He wanted to strike a bargain with religious minorities, whether you were Jewish or Muslim, any kind of non-Christian, as long as you were willing to be loyal to the country and you were willing to fight for the country, you know, then you should be giving all the rights and privileges, full citizenship in the country, in the United States of America. And this is a bargain that both Republican and Democrat presidents, you know, have continued, including George W. Bush, you know, since Dwight D. Eisenhower. And the Trump administration, or the Trump campaign at that, was offering something different. They were offering, let's take away that bargain. Mm-hmm. They were saying, you know, Islam is fundamentally anti-American. Muslims are fundamentally suspicious. So we have to take that away. And Hillary Clinton was drawing the line and saying no. I think actually that she won at least temporarily on the issue of whether or not people like Humayun Khan, who shed his blood for mm-hmm. the country, mm-hmm. Captain Humayun Khan, who shed his blood for the country in the Iraq War, I think she won temporarily on that issue. Because there was a lot of pushback mm-hmm. against Donald Trump's criticism
of
not
this
only.
Gold Star family, of this Gold Star family. He attacked Mrs. Khan and employed a stereotype in the process. So
that's right. That's right. You remember he said he said that he didn't understand why she mm-hmm. was silent mm-hmm. during the speech, and then he said that something akin to, well, that's, you know, how Muslims treat their women. That's not an exact quote. It's using the old stereotype of the oppressed mm-hmm. Muslim woman, and that was highly disrespectful to many, not only Democrats, but also Republicans. And then she came out in the Washington Post and explained that she gets so choked up whenever she speaks about her dead son that she couldn't say anything.
So this bargain you mention that was initiated during the Eisenhower years seems to have evaporated post 9/11. Is that when we saw the erosion in that bargain? Because in 2008, you point out in your book that then-candidate Barack Obama also mentioned the sacrifice of a Muslim soldier, and he was supported in part because of that by Republican Colin Powell, former Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he mentioned then also this concern on the part of his Republican counterparts regarding Muslim Americans.
Yes, in 2008, as Barack Obama was accused of being a secret Muslim, former Secretary of State and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Colin Powell, you know, one of the sort of most historically important African Americans in the country, endorsed Obama in part because he was very concerned about what he considered to be the growing racism and mm-hmm. xenophobia, this fear of the Muslim foreigner, going on inside of his own Republican Party. And he mentioned seeing a picture of a grieving mother at Arlington National Cemetery, mm-hmm. and it's a beautiful picture taken of another soldier whose last name was also Khan, and of his mother at his gravestone. And he said he was deeply moved by that. Colin Powell said he was deeply moved by that picture because He said, you know, the problem is not that Barack Obama, you know, is a Muslim. By the way, Colin Powell said he's not. He's clearly not. He's a Christian. But the problem is saying to young Muslim kids growing up in this country that they don't have, that they can't become president, that they can't, that somehow they're not good enough, that their blood is not worthwhile or worthy enough to sacrifice on the altar of the nation, and that they too can't be president. And that's what disturbed him. For him, it was a defining moment, in the same way for many Americans of his same generation, that the idea that black people, no matter what their religion, weren't somehow qualified or truly American, you know, that they were somehow foreigners in their own country. And so this was, this is since 9/11, the sort of this anti-Muslim hatred and prejudice and fear has been growing as a part of our national life, and it has now seen, you know, a fuller flowering in the election of Donald Trump.
And we'll be right back with more of our conversation with Dr. Edward Curtis, Muslim American expert, and we hope you'll stay with us.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Intimate Realm. A one-day worship symposium with Pastor Rod Lumpkin.
So, Lord, our prayer is that you will keep us ever before you.
And Amante Lacey.
Your Majesty, Lord, we believe.
Saturday, February 25th from 10 till 2 with evening worships at well. Of course, at In His Presence Ministries.
When all else has been said, Jesus.
Pastor Kevin Riley invites you to 4700 South Bowman Road in Little Rock. Call today for more information at 501-246-3305. February 25th, it's a Saturday, beginning at 10 a.m. Come to the Intimate Realm for a one-day worship symposium. Registration is $25 per person or $20 per person for groups of 10 or more. At In His Presence Ministries, 4700 South Bowman Road in Little Rock, or go to ihpwm.org.
Get ready for the 13th annual Mid-South Summit Black Expo, honoring Black History Month. It's all happening Saturday, February 25th at the Metroplex Event Center, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Enjoy food, fun, and entertainment for the entire family. And entrepreneurs display your product to thousands in the Central Arkansas area. Become a sponsor or vendor and take your business to the next level. For vendor and sponsorship packages, call 501-891-1790 or info at timmonsarts.org. And if you are an entertainer or dancer, here's a great opportunity to strut your stuff. That's 501-891-1792 or info at timmonsarts.org. We'll see you Saturday, February 25th for the 13th annual Mid-South Black Expo.
Alberta Faye Hires got her life back thanks to the Arkansas Tobacco Quit Line.
I smoked for 37 years, but with the support of my quit coach, I finally overcame my addiction. The Quit Line helped me set my own goals and turned a few steps into thousands. Now I run marathons. I'm stronger, healthier, and a positive role model for my grandchildren. I'm proud to say that I'm a quitter. You deserve to be proud of yourself, too. When you quit tobacco, you win.
Quit smoking or vaping. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Live tobacco and nicotine free.
One of your favorite family pastimes is going to baseball games. Big tobacco companies want you to believe that chew or snuff is simply part of a time-honored tradition. Smokeless tobacco can become a lifelong addiction that causes mouth sores, bleeding gums, and oral cancer. But smokeless tobacco doesn't have to be part of your tradition. During this year's Great American Spit Out, be the generation that strikes out big tobacco and hits a home run for health. Visit sosprojectprevent.com to learn more.
Welcome back to the Village Celebration Podcast. I'm Vicki Newton. Thank you for joining us. We are talking today with Dr. Edward Curtis, who has written 8 books. His specialty is Muslim American life. Dr. Curtis, is that the best way to describe your specialty? And tell us how you became interested, and what a timely conversation for the nation and the world, actually.
Yeah, I happen to have sort of been lucky enough to prepare in graduate school to do the job that I'm doing now. So I grew up in Southern Illinois and went to Washington University in St. Louis for my master's degree. And as I was studying the practice of Islam at that time, only mostly among African Americans in St. Mm-hmm. Louis, I would go to North Grand Boulevard in St. Louis to Masjid al-Mu'minin, which was a former temple of the Nation of Islam that had become a Sunni mosque under the leadership of W.D. Muhammad. And I came to know that is how I grew up Christian, and am still a Christian, but I came to know about Islam really by hanging out with the brothers and sisters up on North Grand Boulevard and eating fish, mm-hmm. with them and chatting after Friday services. So I prepared in the 1990s to talk about Islam in America. And then, of course, after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, suddenly my academic specialization gave me the opportunity to participate in really, I think, essential discussions in the country about who we are as Americans, who we have been, and who we want to be. And right now, Muslim Americans are at the center of that discussion. They are forcing all of us who are not Muslim to ask the questions about, you know, what are our most important values as Americans?
Well, you bring to the forefront, as you say, the essence of the protests. In the fiber of America is this enduring theme of the immigrant. So most mm-hmm. Americans are from someplace else. In the wake of 9/11, Muslim Americans moved to the forefront, as you said, of this conversation, because they've been in America for centuries. Take us back, because you do so in your book. Even in the Revolutionary War, there were Muslims who fought.
That's right. I mean, there has never been an America after, you know, Columbus, quote-unquote, discovered mm-hmm. America without Muslims. Muslims started to come, and most of them were mainly enslaved African people who came to the Americas since 1492. And so then as the British settled the American colonies, there were Muslims in Maryland, there were Muslims in Georgia and in South Carolina, and some of the longest lasting communities remain there on the sea islands of Georgia, places like Sapelo Island, where we find remnants of African Muslim practices quite late in our own history. So Muslim American history is American history. Mm-hmm. They've always been tied together, mm-hmm. and it's not surprising that Muslims have always been members of the armed services, as every group has been a member, generally speaking, of the armed services. So one of the greatest first stories of Muslim American participation is an enslaved African American Muslim named Bilali Muhammad, who on Sapelo Island, Georgia, was preparing to defend the country, despite the fact that he was enslaved, by the mm-hmm. way, against the British invasion in the War of 1812. And this is particularly poignant because the British were offering African Americans the chance for freedom if they would rebel against the Americans. And in fact, many enslaved black people became free through joining mm-hmm. the British army and fighting the Americans. But African American Muslim Bilali Muhammad refused. He armed his group with a bunch of muskets and prepared to defend the country against, against the British naval invasions. Mm-hmm. So it really goes that we can trace through the 1850s. 50s, the Civil War, when hundreds of Muslims served on both sides for the Union Army and also for the Confederacy. In World War I, thousands of Muslim Americans served, World War II, and until today.
And here we are discussing whether or not they are safe for the country. I want to point out, since we are focused especially on Muslim Americans post 9/11, and that seems to have been the turning point for so much of this blatant discrimination, the countries on the list did not give us the 9/11 terrorists. The countries on that ban, the seven countries. How do you think the administration arrived at those seven?
Well, I don't know all of the internal. I can only judge from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of smart people are trying to figure out what's going on inside. But I mean, the only educated guess I have is that these countries were determined to not be essential to American security interests. So, the United States is a strong supporter of Saudi Arabia,
which is where the 9/11
special relationship. Yes. That's where all the 9/11 hijackers came from.
Yes.
Came from, right? And so it has a special relationship since Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, with Saudi Arabia, supports the kingdom. I think it's fair to say without U.S. support, that kingdom would not have remained standing as it has these many decades. It's a highly undemocratic regime. I think Egypt is not on the list.
Mm-hmm.
That's telling. You know, mm-hmm. Again, the United States has been in strong support of the new dictator president of Egypt, Abdel Fattah Sisi. He engaged in a coup against the democratically elected Muslim Brotherhood president, a coup that was supported by the United States. And at first, President Obama, sort of condemned coups in general, but then in the end, supported the administration of Sisi. So Egypt's not on the list.
Mm-hmm.
The really odd one is Iran. Now, why would Iran be on the list when Iran has produced, no Muslim American terrorists and is an enemy of many of the radical terrorists who commit murder against Westerners in the name of Islam? You know, it doesn't make much sense, but I think it's pretty clear that Iran's on the list because the administration considers Iran to be an enemy of the United States,
mm-hmm.
not because they're actually worried about Iranian
terrorists
or Iranian
on
American
Americans
soil. Committing terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were you stunned at all by the executive order, by the travel ban?
Yes, I can't. I mean, when something that bad happens, at least for me, my worst fears came true. How to put it? It is an amazing thing that it seems like President Trump is doing exactly what he said he was going to do.
Exactly.
Many,
yes.
as in the exit polls coming out of the election, a lot of people thought that he was just sort of, spouting tough rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
No, it turns out that was not just tough rhetoric. He's actually enacting the policies that he proposed on the campaign trail.
And it seems he's trying to enact all of them within 1 month or so. Going forward, what do you see happening? What do you believe at this point would be the best course of action to kind of right this ship, if there is one?
Well, clearly, oftentimes you don't hear academics like myself taking partisan positions, but I've been more explicit. I think that there are times in a country's life when people have to get off the fence and have to decide, where to stand. It seems to me, for the sake of the country, that I can't afford to remain silent about what, for me, are clearly immoral actions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it feels what's going on in the country feels very scary. So, certainly I and other academics and lots of people all around the country from I think what have been and are going to be all walks of life are going to have to resist. I hope in peaceful ways. It is possible to change government policies, but as we saw during the Vietnam War, when massive numbers of people peacefully protested the Vietnam War, it is even showing up in large number in protests will not oftentimes convince the government to change its policies. Instead, the cost has to be ratcheted up, and the society sometimes in order to peacefully change societies, you have to basically go on some sort of general strike. We've had examples of this all over the world, including the Montgomery bus boycott, where with people's dollars, with their work, with their actions, you know, we just don't let society continue as if nothing's wrong. If things continue to get worse, we will all have to make a choice of whether we want to continue as if nothing's happened, or whether we're willing to, you know, suffer for our highest values as human beings. And so that's looking forward. That's what I am as a citizen. I'm looking toward.
Dr. Edward Curtis of the University of Indiana, the author of Muslim Americans in the Military, Centuries of Service, your eighth book. We appreciate your insight. Thank you so much for joining us.
It is my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And we'll be right back. You're listening to The Village Celebration. Recent events in our country have created a grassroots effort to reallocate assets in a way that sustains and supports the African American community. Some are calling this movement Banking Black or Move Our Money. The U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce, or USBC, and Liberty Bank have partnered to offer a credit card with a 9.9% interest rate. The U.S. Black Chambers and Liberty Bank working together in our community. For more information on the credit card, visit libertybank.net/affinity. Use promo code USBC.
Stretch your tax dollars at Butler Furniture Depot and celebrate our 10-year anniversary sale. Biggest sale ever. Use our no-credit check purchase plan with instant approval up to $4,000 with no money down, with 90 days same as cash. 1 month on the job, $1,200 a month income, and an active checking account. Congratulations, you're approved. Free layaway still available. Call 945-1222 for details and directions.
Butler done it, Butler Furniture Depot.
You don't have to play sports to be a champion. On or off the field, each day, you dedicate time and effort to reach your personal goals and dreams. But tobacco use can ruin your hard work and path to higher achievement. If you use tobacco, make a play that brings you one step closer to victory and better health. Call the Arkansas Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW to speak with a quit counselor about free medication and support. It's time to feel like the champion you are.
One of your favorite family pastimes is going to baseball games. Big tobacco companies want you to believe that chew or snuff is simply part of a time-honored tradition. Smokeless tobacco can become a lifelong addiction that causes mouth sores, bleeding gums, and oral cancer. But smokeless tobacco doesn't have to be part of your tradition. During this year's Great American Spit Out, be the generation that strikes out big tobacco and hits a home run for health. Visit sosprojectprevent.com to learn more.
Man, I feel fantastic tonight.
Hey, what's your number?
Wow, didn't know I still had it. But you know what? I'm married.
No, not your phone number. I'm interested in your health. What is your cholesterol number?
My what?
Your cholesterol is a type of fat found in your blood that can put you at risk for heart disease or stroke. There are two types.
Why should I care? I mean, I feel great.
High cholesterol doesn't make you feel bad, but it can kill you. Heart disease is the number one killer in Arkansas and the U.S. Keeping your levels healthy is the first step at living longer.
You know what? I definitely want to be around to see my kids graduate.
Ask someone you love, what's your number?
Your health should be your priority. Take control. Go see your doctor and ask, what's your number? This message is brought to you by the Arkansas Minority Health Commission.
If you're just joining us for the Village Celebration podcast, we were talking with Dr. Edward Curtis about the travel ban, or what most Americans are calling the travel ban. And he indicated that there comes a time in the life of a country and its citizens, a decision time. How do you engage if you oppose the policies? And what we have seen around the country since President Trump was inaugurated are massive protests. Joining us now is Renarda Williams, who has attended the Million Man March and then the second Million Man March. And so, Renarda, you're a contributor to the Village Celebration, and we appreciate all the work you have done. What is it? What's that feeling like at a massive rally like the Million Man March we've seen at the Women's March, that we saw most recently at airports and in cities around the country as pushback to this ban? What is that feeling in the crowd?
It's several feelings. One thing is that you're excited, and another thing is that I'm speaking out. I'm showing America, I'm showing the world that I have something to say, I have something I want to do afterwards. Because a lot of folks think we were just there just to, hey, I'll make history. No, no. We all went back and did things, and that's one of the things I hope that the women would go back and do more things. And matter of fact, that's not the first march. After ours, women took, which
African American Women marched.
So they followed, other things followed, like the Children's Defense Fund had their 1 million march for children. And I just hope that they take back, not just focusing on Trump, but focusing on what they can do to better their communities, etc.
So the rally is really just a launching pad, if you will,
yes,
for civic involvement once, yes, you go back home.
Yes.
It must be encouraging, though, to stand amongst so many who share, yes, your opinion and your values.
It's a great thing, because I met people from all over the United States, and they were just like, yeah, I have this, I have that, I'm glad you feel this way. And we're all on one accord. And once you come together with one accord, you can do anything. And that's one thing that I'm really concerned about with these marches. How many people are going to come together on one accord? Because you have a bunch of people who have different ideologies, and they mention the fact that I want this, I want that. But we have to come together as a whole, especially with times now, to really come together and show our president that we're not going to stand here and take it anymore. That also we have to go back home and do something to energize the communities.
There is quite a bit of energy in America. Most recently, the protests at UC Berkeley. We have seen,
yes,
protests at college campuses all around the nation. How important is the millennial pushback to this time?
Very important, because they have something to follow on, looking at all the other marches and say to themselves, like, what can I do? What can we do? Here we are. And I think once they get the gist of it and realize that, okay, we can start this, let's take over where they left off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think every march need to take over where the other one left off. And I think the Million Man March was probably the prime example. But what I always talk about this, but what upset me was the fact that when we returned home to our communities, no one really got involved with our local organizing communities or anything. They criticized us more than push us from about, okay, where now, what can we do to help? And I can tell you a ton of stories about what happened to me in Monroe, Louisiana. But we just have to go on. We have to go forward and take what we have and what we've learned from those marches and energize the community.
Well, they do serve as a template,
yes,
for rallies.
Yes.
But what may also assist and has changed greatly since the Million Man March is the use of social media.
Yes.
Which allows protesters to stay in touch and galvanize pretty much at a moment's notice.
That's very important, you know, when you get it out there, you know, Facebook and all these other things, people would read and say, oh, wow, I want to get involved with this.
You mean Facebook Live? Yeah. I've watched a lot of protests in other cities just on Facebook Live. So the protest movement itself has changed. The way people protest has changed dramatically since the Million Man March, which I suppose deserves even more credit given the, in hindsight, rather archaic methods used to organize.
Yeah, I think some of these folks are going too far, like Berkeley. I mean, throwing things through windows, etc.
You mean the civil disobedience, which often works against the point protesters are trying to make.
And that's what they look at. Oh, these protests are nothing but violence. No, they're not. And I'm a part of that. I mean, we didn't throw things. We were all peaceful. But what still irks me, Vicky, is the fact that the aftermath, people have to get involved. Okay, just don't say I was there. Get involved. And I got involved in extra activities before the march. I was in this and that and all that. I increased. You have to do more to get the community behind you and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. Start our businesses. We're going to improve education and do those things. Just don't procrastinate.
So you need a plan, which is what we often heard as a criticism, if you will, of the Black Lives Matter movement. Yeah. What is the plan? And they did eventually release plan. So you're saying, most importantly, once you rally and the media covers the rally and there is this sense of making a difference.
Yes, you have to make a difference.
You then need a plan. Okay, that's our final word. We'll see what the plan what the plan is in response to the travel ban. Yes. Is it the midterm elections in 2018? Is that what people are looking forward to next? Or are there some intermediate goals that a lot of protesters are working to accomplish? These are certainly interesting times. Back in a moment. Renata Williams, thank you for joining us.
You're most welcome.
If you're like me, always on the go without the time to constantly detail your car, then you need to try Miracle Glaze products. Miracle Glaze is the world's best tire shine. It's water resistant and guaranteed to leave a glossy finish on tires that last for weeks. Just spray, let it dry, and you're good to go with a non-drip, non-slinging look people can't help but notice. If you're really trying to make a statement, complete the look with the Miracle Glaze Wash and Wax. You can get yours at MiracleGlaze.com, HHM.com, or call 501-454-6630. Miracle Glaze, it's the pro's choice.
Pick up some today. Non-sling Miracle Glaze, super gloss tire dressing.
What's in a name? W.C. Mitchell & Associates Tax and Financial Services is a name that means business. For experience, honesty, integrity, and loyalty, W.C. Mitchell & Associates Tax and Financial Services is a name that you can trust. If you're tired of waiting on your refund, W.C. Mitchell & Associates Tax and Financial Services can help. They prepare your taxes electronically and get you your money fast.
This is W.C. Mitchell, and at W.C. Mitchell & Associates Tax and Financial Services, we treat you like family with tender, loving care.
W.C. Mitchell & Associates Tax and Financial Services specializes in clergy and church tax preparation for salary housing allowance, deferred compensation, investment counseling, payroll, social security, retirement, estate planning, and much more. W.C. Mitchell & Associates is expertly familiar with all IRS tax codes. W.C. Mitchell & Associates Tax and Financial Services is waiting on your call. 501-324-2690. Again, that's 501-324-2690. Or you can come by 201 West Broadway, Suite F in North Little Rock.
Get ready for the 13th annual Mid-South Summit Black Expo. Honoring Black History Month. It's all happening Saturday, February 25th at the Metroplex Event Center, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Enjoy food, fun, and entertainment for the entire family. And entrepreneurs display your product to thousands in the Central Arkansas area. Become a sponsor or vendor and take your business to the next level. For vendor and sponsorship packages, Texas. Call 501-891-1790 or info at timmonsarts.org. And if you are an entertainer or dancer, here's a great opportunity to strut your stuff. That's 501-891-1792 or info at timmonsarts.org. We'll see you Saturday, February 25th for the 13th Annual Mid-South Black Expo.
Again, you've been listening to the Village Celebration Podcast, and we have dedicated today's edition to the protest movement underway, in large part spawned by this Muslim ban. Dr. Edward Curtis joined us, and Renarda Williams, a Village Celebration contributor, joined us as well. Both spoke of this moment in time. What is your reaction? How will you engage if you oppose the president's policies? What will you do beyond sitting and watching it on TV or your phone and discussing it with those closest to you? What will you do? We leave you with what is quite possibly the most popular anthem for civic involvement from the 60s, Marvin Gaye. I'm Vicki Newton, and this is the Village Celebration. The contents of this broadcast are the exclusive property of the Village Celebration. Any duplication, rebroadcast, or any other use is strictly prohibited, and it is not permitted without the express written consent of the Village Celebration.
everybody thinks we're all a mother. Who are they to judge us?
Mother, mother,
simply calls me where I hello.
Mother, mother,
ooh.